Washington, D.C. is the center of American politics. But issues debated here in the nation's capital are usually ground out of the political mills and the pressures of the 48 states, in that vast, elusive area of power called the grassroots. Sometimes Washington may seem like a remote summit to citizens thousands of miles from the seat of government, but 48 governors help to bridge that gap at the annual governor's conference and in congressional committee hearings. They also lead delegations to see the president. They often control votes at the Republican and Democratic national conventions. And 16 governors have become president of the United States. On the American Forum today are two young governors, examples of the fresh, vigorous leadership both parties turn to for the future. They're geographical neighbors in the industrial heartland of America's Midwest, but political opposites in their approaches to the election issues of 56. From Michigan, G. Menon Williams, Democrat, now in his fourth term as governor, outspoken critic of the administration. And from Indiana, Governor George Craig, Republican, first World War II veteran to be national commander of the American Legion, a staunch supporter of President Eisenhower. Well, gentlemen, both your terms of office expire this year, but before getting to that, I want to get off to this slogan, the phrase peace and prosperity. You know, it's beginning to be used a great deal as a slogan during this election year, and I wonder if you'd sort of tell us, gentlemen, what this means to you, Governor Williams.
Well, usually I don't like to fight my political battles on the opponent's home grounds, but peace and prosperity, I think we could say, should be rephrased. What peace, what prosperity? Today we have more hot spots around the world than we've ever had before. There's lack of security, not only among our friends, but right here at home as to what the future will be as Dulles goes to the brink and as we cut our military budget, not by military considerations, but by political considerations. And when we talk about prosperity, sure, there's prosperity for GM, but not even for GM dealers. And there's still 12.5 million families, not individuals, 12.5 million families that don't have enough money to live on a normal subsistence of $2,000 a year.
Let me go to Governor Craig and ask his opinion of that.
Well, I think there's only one thing wrong with Governor Williams' statement, and that is that it's incorrect. When President Eisenhower came in, the administration of the Democrat Party under President Truman was engaged in a Korean War. That war was terminated by President Eisenhower and this administration. As for there being hot spots all over the world, I can assure you that there is no more Indochina, and there is no more Korea. The matter between Pakistan and India has eased off remarkably, and while we have always had disagreements between nations in the world's family of nations, there is more leadership on the part of the American people in the free world today than ever before in the history of America. This idea, when will I finish? This idea that you can play off the thing by saying that there isn't any prospect of peace. I remind Governor Williams and everyone listening to this office, this program, that for the first time in many, many years, no American soldier is being killed on a battlefield, and that has been true during the entire Eisenhower administration.
Governor, now, as far as prosperity is concerned,
well, we've got a whole half hour, Governor. We'll get into the
but
details.
The idea on prosperity is this, even in Governor Williams' hometown of Detroit.
I want to hear that prosperity, but in fairness,
too.
I want to go
I'd
back
like
to Governor Williams
what he
at this point.
To say. Well, let me say that Governor Craig spoke only too well when he said no more Korea, no more Indochina. For the North Koreans, there is no more Korea. And for those in the northern part of Indochina, those people have receded behind the Iron Curtain since the advent of the Eisenhower administration.
The line is just exactly where President Roosevelt and Stalin drew it, the 38th parallel.
In Indochina?
And that is where it is right now, and the same is true of the matters in Indochina and the other agreements that were made at Tehran and Potsdam without the knowledge of the American people in secrecy and never divulged until after the advent of the last Democrat administration, in which the rights of the American people were bartered away in time of war between the leaders of nations without the consent of the Senate or the Congress of the United States. Now, let me go into this matter of prosperity.
Well, wait a moment. Let me answer that one question.
Prosperity. Let him answer that particular one, and we'll go back to prosperity, Governor.
I noticed that at Geneva, President Eisenhower and Dulles were very careful to stay away from the Yalta, because Yalta granted self-determination to those countries now behind the Iron Curtain. And President Eisenhower did nothing there where he could have been effective to try and get for the Polish and other people of Eastern Europe their right of self-determination and immediate elections, free elections, now.
Governor Craig, sir.
Well, now, I recall that, Governor Williams, it was your party, the Democrat Party, in 1933, over the objection of the Republican Party, that recognized Soviet Russia. I will also refresh your memory by pointing out that it was President Roosevelt that sold out the Polish people and made the agreement with Stalin that included them within the boundaries and the limitations of the Iron Curtain.
Now,
and I will further call to your remembrance the fact that all of the dealing with the communist nations from 1933 until 1948 were conducted by the Democrat parties to the point where they even infiltrated into the highest sanctity and sanctums of our government.
Governor Williams.
I must say that never has any of the Democrats embraced the Republicans as President Eisenhower did at Geneva. And when you refer to the Yalta Agreement, you fail to remember that that provided for self-determination, which your party has failed to recognize and failed to press when they made the agreements at the Spirit of Geneva meeting.
Well, gentlemen, I wonder if we could move along in terms of issues of 56. Now, Governor, you wanted to get into the prosperity. Do you feel you've had your chance for the prosperity?
Well, of course not. I haven't even spoken on it.
We haven't had a chance at prosperity either. Let's hear what he has.
Well, let me point out that in 1952, the last year of your political party's administration and domination of the American people, we had employed 61,293,000 people. This year, we have employed 63,105,000 people. Now, let me take the automobile industry. You're interested in that out there in Detroit and Michigan. When President Roosevelt, his last year as president, your automobile worker was making $204 an hour, $2.04 an hour. Now he's making $2.28 an hour. His weekly wage under the best year that President Truman had was $82.82, and now, this last year passed, he's making $96.94. Now, the average income per family for the entire United States in President Truman's best year was $67.97. In the last year passed, $76.33. In other words, there has been a gradual and constant increase in the wages and the income of the American public. There has been a decrease in unemployment. And this, mind you, Governor Williams, has been done without the aid of a Korean War.
Governor Williams, sir.
Well, I'm very happy that the American worker has been able to increase. That has been something which has been going on for the last 20 or 30 years, and under a Democratic administration will continue to go on. But the thing I'd like to point out is that while big business profits, for example, have gone up 46% since the advent of the Eisenhower administration, small business is down 66%. Small business failures are up 36%. And farm parity has dropped down to 84. And there are still 12.5 million American families that don't have a subsistence of $2,000 a year. And I think that we in America should certainly continue to build for the prosperity of our people, and these soft spots should be taken care of as well.
Gentlemen, in terms of, did you care to answer that, Governor Craig?
I think I'm entitled to answer his
Indeed
statements,
so, sir.
Mr. McCormick.
Indeed so.
I would say that that cannot be identically true with the situation today. It is true that there are in the United States today 2,675,000 unemployed. Now that out of approximately 150 million people. But during this period that Governor Williams speaks of, the income of the American people have arisen from $300 million annual income to $325 million annual income. The wages of the employees have gone up, as I have indicated. The number of unemployed have gone down, which you must concede. Now, all this has been done, plus the fact that your income taxes individually have been cut 10%, that other taxes have been cut $4 million, making a total savings in tax collection of $7 million. This, mind you, under a system of financing that this year, for the first time since 1951, balances the budget of the United States, and the second time since 1932. Now, if it can be said...
Now, wait a moment.
Mr. Truman balanced
the budget for four times, and I don't think you can dispute that.
I certainly would dispute it. He never balanced it but once, except in the 80th Congress when it was balanced
in
1951.
All right.
The rest of the time was deficit spending.
Let's look to the record on that. Now, I certainly agree, as I said before, that wages are going up and should go up. But what do you think of these additional failures of small business? What do you think of the farmers being pushed off the farm? Isn't that a social as well as an economic problem? What do you think of your assistant to the Secretary of Agriculture, Don Paarlberg, that says that the farmers have been living in a dream world? Do you think it's a dream world when the farmers have an opportunity to get a decent living and all the profits don't go to the middleman?
Governor Craig.
Well, I would say, if you're going to discuss the farm problem, that the farm income at the present year's annual ending is not satisfactory. I will say, however, that it has been brought about by your party.
When
now,
our party
just a minute,
was
you
in
ask
power,
a bunch of questions
was
and I'm
at 100 parity.
In 1942... You placed a 100% parity in order to meet the requirements and demands of a world war, not only to meet ourselves, our own requirements, but that of our neighbors and allies. And then when you came to 1946, when it should have been terminated, where the requirements for those great masses of food that the American farmer patriotically met was no longer necessary, you found out it was a good way to continue to get the farmer's vote. And you continued to increase the production of the American farmer until you built up over $7 billion worth of surplus. And when the Eisenhower administration came in, you had over $7 million worth of grain stacked up and stashed away that had been bought with taxpayers' money, asking the American farmer to produce more than the American people and their friends could eat, simply so that by the means of
that expediency...
You could gain the farmer's vote.
Governor Williams.
And make him dependent upon
that's
government.
That's a very,
Governor
very Williams. Interesting statement indeed, because when the Democrats were in power, the farmers were both getting an adequate income and the people having an opportunity to eat. There is larger surpluses today under the Republicans than were under the Democrats. And let's just examine this thing about producing more food than the people can eat. Actually, today, 28% of the children of our country are undernourished. 10% of them go to school without having had a breakfast or having had an adequate breakfast. If we had produced, or rather, if our people had had $2,000 income, all of them, we would have eaten 167 billion pounds of milk, which is just 40 billion pounds of milk more than we've had. If we'd had an adequate income for all of our people, there would be no surpluses. And I think it is up to whichever administration is in power to see that each and every one of our families have an opportunity to at least give their children an adequate diet. And when we talk about farm surpluses, let's remember about that. Let's feed the hungry before we start talking about those surpluses.
I entirely agree with you. And instead of feeding the hungry since 1942 to 1948, instead of putting it in your stomachs, you put it in these tin containers sticking around all over the United States. Now, you're the one that built up the surplus, and you're now coming to the American people after harboring $7 billion worth of grain and talking about distribution? Let me ask you, how would you distribute it?
Well, let me point out, first of all, that in the 2 years of the Republican administration, they spent over $403 million on the support program. We spent only 20. But yet, under your administration, the price has dropped, or rather the parity has dropped to 84. Now, I'd be glad to tell you about how to distribute this. I think the first thing we've got to continue to see that our workers get increasing wages. Another thing we can well do is to take care of the distribution of that surplus. Now, one of the ways that's been devised is the school milk program. The Congress appropriated $50 million. This administration used only 17, turned back 33, but yet there are many, many school children that even aren't covered
under
this milk program.
We just got through going into the market, or in preparation of going into the market, buying $85 million worth of fresh pork, which is a perishable and which has to be worked off immediately, and that is being done through the school lunch program. However...
I said the school milk program.
Well, that's school milk, school lunch. I mean, lunch and milk, are they complement one another because they are free distributions to our school children, which I favor, as does most everyone else.
Well, gentlemen, with many issues to talk about and with a few minutes left, I wonder if we could, for the moment, get beyond the farm program and talk about a few others. For instance, I'm certain one of the things that our viewers and listeners are concerned with is what role will labor, or will labor play a role in this election year of 56? There's been the big labor merger, AFL and CIO. Does that have an effect? What sort of position does labor have in the minds of both of you in this election year? Governor Craig.
Well, I think that labor, management, agriculture, and all of the various classifications of our avocations of people... all have a great bearing on elections. Labor, of course, is a great and potential potent force in America. However, I think that the Republican Party has demonstrated its cooperation and recognition of the rights of labor by bringing about the highest wages in the history of America, the most employed, and the finest of working conditions. Now, the Democrat Party has, for time immemorial, made a whipping boy out of American business. My idea is this. You can't make a whipping boy out of any group of American people. To have prosperity and happiness in America, you've got to have the companionship of management and labor, farmer, and all of the other people that make up this great society of ours. And it's a cooperative effort to see that all are prosperous and happy without singling out anybody to be punished, maligned, or otherwise abused by government or by any other force within our society.
Let me go to Governor Williams.
I think Mr. Craig has stated very well the objectives to be achieved. We should have a harmonious society, and I think that both of us strive for it. It's just the method by which it is done. I don't think that labor felt particularly happy, nor did the farmers, when in these tax reductions, which Governor Craig spoke about a few minutes ago, the lion's share went to the corporations and large investors. I don't think labor felt that they had a square deal when President Eisenhower insisted that he was going to change the Taft-Hartley Act and hasn't done anything yet, has made it impossible, for example, for labor and management to bargain easily together, when the NLRB has withdrawn its support in many fields of operation. Now, I think that, going right to your question, I think that it's a very significant thing that the AFL and CIO have merged. I think that that'll give them an opportunity to be of greater service. Now, I recognize that getting together means greater responsibilities on their part. And if they don't follow that out, then I am sure that the public will take recognition of that. But from my past experience with both the AFL and the CIO, I am sure that they are going to put the public interest first.
One other question obviously comes to mind, since we have two governors on the program today, and that is the relation of the states to the federal government, and certainly of real interest now is this question of federal aid educationally. Governor Craig, do you feel that you'll need the money, or you'll have the money? What sort of a program do you think would be a good one for your state? Is the administration program acceptable to you?
If you're speaking of Indiana, Indiana does not need federal aid education. We're able to provide that standard of education and those structures of capital investment for housing adequately to reach the highest standards. I am, however, in favor, if there are states, if there are communities within states that cannot receive the proper amount of money to have the highest and finest standards of education, then I feel that if the states or the local communities cannot or will not assume it, then I feel that it is proper for the federal government to do so. That does not apply to Indiana. We're in good shape and going along fine.
You feel the administration's proposals, as now presented, are satisfactory and workable?
That's right. That's, briefly, I have stated what I understand the administration's proposals to be.
Governor Williams, may I ask you about federal aid and your relations, sir, in Michigan, and how do you feel about it there?
Well, I feel this. I feel that the complacency expressed by Governor Craig is absolutely fatuous. Because I know that in his state, as in almost every state in the Union, there are thousands of children going to school in everything from basements to tents. And until such time as every child in America has an opportunity to go to school in a decent schoolroom, then we must use our financial resources wherever we can best get them. Now, it's true, of course, that each state possibly could, if it didn't do anything else, if it didn't build roads, if it didn't take care of its police and everything, could take care of its schools. But the sad fact is that they don't. And so federal aid is necessary. Now, the federal aid program, which has been proposed by this administration, is inadequate. $250 million over 5 years comes to $1.25 billion. $1.25 billion matches very poorly with the $16 billion which the administration itself admits is needed. Now, so far, the states have only put up $2 billion a year, and so Uncle Sam is going to have to help, and it's going to have to do a lot better
Governor
than President
Eisenhower. Governor Craig.
I think, Governor, you'd better confine yourself to Michigan and leave us folks in Indiana out of this. Now, I don't know what your situation is in Michigan, but I do know this, that the people of Indiana maintain this attitude as they do in many states. We try to solve our own problems first. If we cannot, then we will come to the federal government. But we have no right to come to the federal government until we have exhausted our own remedies locally. This idea of making the states, the schools, dependent upon the federal government is a fallacy and should not be followed unless it is absolutely necessary to provide the highest standards of education.
Mr. Craig, I can't agree with you more highly. I believe in states' rights and state obligations, too. But I don't have to point out your state. We can go to any state in the Union.
I believe you're a little ignorant about what transpires in Indiana. I'm not going to claim any particular knowledge of Michigan except your fishing. I think it's pretty good.
Thank you very much. If you can, go to the parents of Indiana and say that every child there is housed in a schoolroom where there are not more than 30 children. If they have enough teachers adequately paid, then I'm going to come around and pin a rose on you.
Well, I don't particularly want you to pin a rose on me, but I can assure you this, that while we do not have all of the formulas met that you speak of, which is the utopian idea, we're getting them, we have the money to do it, and we're going to do it ourselves without hopping in here to Washington to ask some bureau to give us the money and then in turn tell us what to teach our children. That we're not going to do in Indiana.
We're not going to have that done either.
Well, you take the money from the federal government and you take the dictation from the federal government. It has been true in every other federally subsidized program that we've experienced since you New Dealers started it back in 1933.
Governor Williams.
Well, that's a new date for the New Deal.
Well,
but,
that's the one when we first became cognizant of the fact that we were saddled with this thing.
Governor Williams.
In any event, I think that everyone agrees that federal dictation is not in the cards, and I am sure that you'd be insulting President Eisenhower's leadership if you'd say that he was wanting to take over the schools.
I wouldn't be worried as long as President Eisenhower is there. He won't always be there, and what would worry me if we had a Roosevelt or a Truman back again... Law, I can't say what might happen.
Well, speaking of President Eisenhower, gentlemen, we have a few minutes. Let's talk about personalities in the campaign this 56th year. I know that both of you are much concerned about that, and before we get into, President Eisenhower and whether or not he will announce, I'd like to ask about yourselves. Your terms of office expire, and do you have any political plans? Governor Craig, may I ask you?
Well, I, of course, want to arrange my affairs so I'll have more time to fish in Michigan. I have no political plans whatsoever, except I look forward eagerly to the opportunity of assisting President Eisenhower in the convention at San Francisco and then in turn participating in the affairs of his election, which I am confident will be successful.
Let me ask Governor Williams, sir. I know that you're in your fourth term now as governor. Do you have any plans, Governor? You've been mentioned quite often as a presidential or vice presidential candidate.
At present, I have only two occupations. One is that of trying to get through the present legislative session and to give the state of Michigan the best legislation possible. And second, I'm interested to see that the Democratic Party provide the people the opportunity to vote on a forward-looking progressive program.
Mm-hmm. One question I want to ask you, too, now, Governor. Do you feel that the business of the president in announcing or not announcing, what effect does that have in terms of the machinery of the Democrats? Does it throw a monkey wrench in if he puts off this announcing business, say, for 2-3 months?
Well, I think this thing has been a matter of speculation for so long that both parties must have prepared themselves for either eventuality if they had to worry one way or the other.
Governor Craig, how do you feel about it, sir?
The Republican Party is in excellent shape and willing to meet the issues and even the hypothecations that the Democrats undoubtedly will present during the next...
You got all the old golden promises?
Well, sir, you know, we not only have them, but, you know, the last 2-3 years, we've kept them.
I must interrupt, gentlemen. It's time to end today's discussion.
I wish that were true.
Our guests today, and we thank them very much, Governor G. Menon Williams, Democrat of Michigan, and Governor George Craig, Republican of Indiana. The nation's first discussion program, the American Forum, is now in its 27th year, founded and produced by Theodore Granick. This is Steve McCormick bidding you goodbye.
Listen again next week when the American Forum will again present another subject of importance to you. For reprints of today's discussion on the American Forum, send 10 cents to Ramsdell Incorporated, Printers and Publishers, Washington 18, D.C. That's Ramsdell Incorporated, Printers and Publishers, Washington 18, D.C. America's oldest unrehearsed discussion program is dedicated to the public debate of all issues vital to you and your country. The American Forum is produced by its founder, Theodore Granick, directed by Frank Slinglin. This is Ray Quinn speaking. This program came to you from Washington, D.C. This has been an NBC presentation.
We thank you, gentlemen, very much. We'll be looking forward to monitoring you again next week. And now, as we conclude this hour of Monitor, I'd like to remind you about Weekday, an NBC radio service that can do much to make your Monday through Friday routine go faster and brighter. Margaret Truman, Mike Wallace, Martha Scott, and Walter Kiernan are the hosts. There'll be dramatic readings, news, extremely interesting discussions, and fascinating guests. Tomorrow, for example, Gladys Swarthout will drop by. And on Tuesday, the star of Damn Yankees, Gwen Verdon. Make Weekday a listening habit.